Ever since he was 4 years old, I had begun to think seriously, as a boy should. David Blaze had been aware that there was a real world lying somewhere just below the ordinary old thing in which his father and mother and nurse and the rest of the fast asleep grown-up people lived. Boys began to get drowsy, he knew, about the time they were 10. Though they might still have occasional waking moments, and soon after that, they went sound asleep and lost all chance of ever seeing the real world. If you asked grown-ups some tremendously important question, such as, why do the leaves fall off the trees when there is glass on the lake? As likely as not, they would begin talking in their sleep about frost and sap, just as if that had got anything to do with the real reason. Or they might point out that it wasn't really glass on the lake, but ice, and if they were more than usually sound asleep, take a piece of the lake glass and let you hold it in your fingers till it became water. That was to show you that what you had called glass was really frozen water, another word for which was ice. And they thought that it was very wonderful of them to explain it all so nicely and tell you at great length that real glass did not become water if you held it in your fingers, which you must remember to wash before dinner. Perhaps they would take you to the nursery window when you came in from your walk and encourage you to put your finger on the pane in order to see that glass did not become water. This sort of thing would make David impatient, and he asked, why don't you put ice in the window, and then you could boil it for tea in the kettle? And if his nurse wanted to go to sleep again, she would say, now you're talking nonsense, Master David. Now that was the ridiculous thing. Of course he was talking nonsense, just to humor Nanny. He was helping her with her nonsense about the difference between ice and glass. He had been wanting to talk sense all the time and learn something about the real world, in which the fish put a glass roof on their house for the winter as soon as they had collected enough red fire leaves to keep them warm until the hot weather came round again. That might not be the precise way in which it happened, but it was something of that sort. Instead of pinching herself awake, poor sleepy Nanny went babbling on about ice and glass and sap and spring in a way that was truly tedious and quite beside the real point. Yet when the sleepy things tried to wake to the real world, they could not get their grown-up dreams out of their heads. Sometimes his mother would come up to the nursery before he went to bed and take him on her knee, which was a soft, comfortable place, and tell him a story, which often began quite well and seriously. And David always asked that the electric light should be put out first, because then the flame cats would come out of their holes and play puss in the corner all over the nursery. They always helped the story to seem true and serious, for they were real. Only the electric light must be put out first, because it gave them shocks. And naturally, you could not play when you were being shocked. And he knew that to be true, even in the sleepy grown-up world, because once, when his mother was playing with him, he had put out his tongue at Nanny, when she came to say it was bedtime, and his mother couldn't play anymore because she was shocked. That was why the flame cats must have the electric light put out. Well, there were the flame cats dancing. Sometimes they had a ball instead of puss in the corner, and here was he very comfortable and wide awake. Sometimes, as I have said, the story began quite well, with an air of truth and reality about it. There was a little green man with whiskers who lived in the pear tree and washed his hands with pear's soap. Or There was a red-faced old woman who lived in the apple tree and kept a sharp lookout for dumplings coming round the corner, for these were her deadliest enemies, and pulled pieces off her and made them into apple dumplings. Sometimes they pulled her nose off when they caught her, or a finger or two, which never grew again till next spring. And often, if spring was late, from going to sleep again after Nanny Equinox had called him, there was practically nothing left of her. So, when the regiments of dumplings came round the corner, Grandmama Appletree hid in the grass and pretended she was Mr. Windfall, the tailor, who had made David's new sailor clothes. And then Colonel Dumpling would stumble over her, and sometimes he did not know whether she was Grandmama Appletree or Mr. Windfall. So he began very politely, like a subscription paper with a halfpenny stamp in case it proved to be Mr. Windfall, who had the habit of eating Colonel Dumpling whenever he saw him, and often some privates as well, cleared his throat and said, in his best sooty voice, "Oh, dear sir or madam," he never got further than that, because if it proved to be Mr. Windfall, Mr. Windfall ate him, whether he had an apple inside or not. And if it was Grandmama Appletree, she was so indignant, as every proper female should be at being taken for a man, she began abusing Colonel Dumpling in a red voice if she was ripe, and a green one if she wasn't, and gave the whole show away. As though she lost an arm or a leg if there were many people in the house, or a finger or two if father and mother were alone. And Colonel Dumpling said to his regiment, "Attention! Slow fatigue march! Right about kitchen! Turn!" Now, all this sort of thing was clearly true and belonged to the real world. But too often, unfortunately, David's mother got grown up and sleepy again and began talking the most dreadful nonsense. A little girl with golden hair and blue eyes made her unwelcome presence known by singing, or a baby would be found underneath a gooseberry bush. David always hoped that it got frightfully pricked. Or a sweet, lovely fairy would fly in just when everything was getting on so nicely and make rubbish out of it. He was too polite to let his mother know how boring she had become. And so, whenever the golden-haired little girl or the sweet fairy appeared, he would try to go on with Colonel Dumpling's part of the story in his own mind, or watch the flame cats getting tired as the fire burned low. And Nanny was not so good at stories, but she had flashes of sense. As when, one night, when David preferred to sit up in bed instead of lying down to go to sleep, she hinted that a black shadow man might possibly come down the chimney unless he put his head properly on the pillow. And David knew that it was not likely, for it would have to be a very small man indeed, and fireproof, but there was some glimmering of a real idea in it. So he was not the least frightened, and asked with interest if he would be like bacon or beef before he got through the fire. This exploded any sense there might have been in Nanny's original idea at once, because she threatened to go downstairs and tell his mother if he wouldn't lie down. A very poor ending to the black shadow man coming down the chimney. Nanny clearly knew nothing about him, really, if she so quickly got sleepy and talked about fetching his mother. Nobody grown up ever woke to the real world for more than a minute or two at a time. Except perhaps his father, who spent so many hours in a big room called the laboratory. There, he seemed to dabble in realities, for he could put a fragment of something on the water, and it began to blaze. Or he could mix a powder out of certain bottles, and when it was lit, it burned with so red a flame that his father looked as if he was illuminated inside like a turnip ghost. Or he could, by another mixture, produce a smell that he said was tincture of rotten eggs and was really made of the ghosts of bad eggs ground up and exorcised. But then, poor man, he got grown up, and when subsequently David wanted to know what the ghosts of bad eggs looked like when they were exorcised, he muttered in his sleep something about sulfurated hydrogen. David was now just turned 6, as Nanny expressed it, and knew that he had only about 4 years more in front of him before he began to lapse into that drowsy state of grown-uppishness, which begins when boys are 10 or thereabouts and lasts, getting worse and worse, till they are 20 or 70 or anything else. If he was going to find the real world of which he caught glimpses now and then, he must do so without losing much time. There was probably a door into it. For a long time, he had hoped that it was the door in the ground by the lake. One day he had found that door open, and it was an awful disappointment to see that it only contained a tap and a round opening, to which presently the gardener affixed a long curly pipe. And when he turned the tap, the pipe gave some jolly chuckling noises and began to stream with water at its far end. And that was very delightful and consoled David a little for the disappointment. And then one night, he had a clue. He had just lain down in his bed when he heard a door beginning to behave, as doors do when they think they're quite alone and nobody's looking. And then, as you know, they unlatch themselves and begin walking to and fro on their hinges, hitting themselves against their frames. This often happened to the nursery door when he came downstairs in the morning, after he was quite sure he had shut it. His mother therefore sent him up to shut it again, and sure enough, the door was always open, having undone itself to go for a walk on its hinges. But on this night, he thought that the sound of the door came from under his pillow. But he very carelessly fell asleep just as he was listening in order to make sure. And the next thing he knew was that Nanny was telling him it was morning. Again, on the very next night, he had only just put his head on the pillow when the door began banging. It sounded muffled, and there was no doubt this time that it came from under his pillow. Well, he sat up in bed, broad awake, and pulled his pillow away. By the light of the flame cats who were dancing tonight, he could see the smooth white surface of his bolster, but alas, there was no door there. And David was now quite sure that somewhere under his pillow was the door he was looking for. One time he had allowed himself to go to sleep before finding it, The other time, he had got too much awake. So, on the third night, he took the pin partridge to bed with him in the hope that it would keep him just awake enough by pricking him with the head of its pin leg. The pin partridge had, of course, come out of Noah's Ark, and in the course of some terrible adventures had lost a leg, so Nanny had taken a pin and driven it up into the stump so that it could stand again. The pin leg was rather longer than the wooden one, which made the partridge lean a little to one side, as if it was listening to the agreeable conversation of the animal next to it. Sure enough, on this third night, David had only just lain down with the pin partridge in one hand and the pin ready to scratch his leg to keep him just awake enough when the door began banging again just below his pillow. He listened a little while, pressing the pinhead against his calf so that it hurt a little, but not enough to wake him up hopelessly, and moved his head about till he was sure that his ear was directly above the door. Then, very quietly, he pushed his pillow aside, and there, in the middle of his bolster, was a beautiful shining blue door with a gold handle swinging gently to and fro as if it was alone. He got up, pushed it open, and entered. For fear of some dreadful misfortune happening, like finding his mother on the other side of it, who might send him back to shut it, he closed it very carefully and softly. He found that there was a key hanging up on the wall beside it, and to his great joy, it fitted the keyhole. He locked it and put the key back on its nail, so that when he came back, he could let himself out. And in the meantime, nobody could possibly reach him.